760 KFMB. San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB, presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer for It's Your Money and Your Life, coming to you live on this drizzly Sunday night from KFMB in their studios here in beautiful Kearny Mesa with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but L.A. County, Orange County, Riverside County, up the coast to Seattle on a good night, and every Sunday night here's a good night. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour, my co-host. He's a philanthropist. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He is a marathon runner, and he is a family office expert to many high-net-worth families, and his name is Richard Muzio. And Richard, how are you tonight?
I'm great. So guess what happened driving into me?
Tell me.
I hit a little bit more hail driving over.
Again?
Yeah, it wasn't as bad as last week. Last week was an actual hail storm. This time it was just about a minute of a few hailstones. But I'm thinking, what are the odds of me being hailed upon while driving to the radio show two Sunday evenings in a row
in
San Diego?
Richard, the heavens part when we're about to go on the air.
I guess. It's a good, so hail two Sundays in a row.
I'll take it as a good omen.
In fact, we're not going to tell who our guest is yet, but he's really good with calculating probability. We'll ask him what the odds of that are because I know it's really, really low.
Well, let's get the actuaries to work on that. So, but anyway, how was your week this week?
It was good. I want to thank my dear friends, Sherry Kane and David Kane, who fed me before I came over here. Every year we have a New Year's prediction party where we write down our New Year's predictions at the start of the year, and then we put them in an envelope, and we read them the next year when we do new predictions. And
well, how'd you do last year?
I was 5 for 5, but if you... I even predicted Heath Bell would get traded.
Oh, really?
Yeah, how about that for minutia?
What were the other four?
I don't remember, but it was... one was funny. The Chargers will get a new special teams coach. I was right on that, I think, twice.
We got more than that.
Oh, man. Oh, for you Chicago guys, I predicted the Cubs would not win the World Series,
but that's too easy. That's a gimme, for God's sake.
So anyway, thanks, David and Sherry, for having me over for dinner, and I made more predictions for next year, but I can't say what those are.
Yeah, David was a good guest of ours
was a good guest about a year ago.
I do recall.
Benefits expert. So yeah, we do that every year, make some predictions, have a lot of laughs, and then you put on the envelope yes or no. So if you're not there next year, if your envelope says no, we can't read it out in public. If it says yes, we can read it in public. So it was a lot of fun.
Anyway, I had some family. My nephews in town and their mom and dad, and I had forgotten how crazy and fun the Corvette Diner was. We brought them over there for lunch yesterday on their last day in town. And if you haven't been to the new spot in Liberty Station, get over there. It's if you have kids or relatives in the zero.
Or if you're like me and you just happen to be an immature adult, get over there.
I got to say, my 50-year-old brother, he was just as bad as they were in that video game room. He's
there you go.
Playing the... and then also, one of our former guests was Isabel Cruz, and we visited two of her restaurants this week, the Cantina in Pacific Beach and Coffee Cup in La Jolla, and both great places, both healthy, good food, and so we enjoyed those very much. So
we've got a special guest tonight.
And who might that be?
That's one of our sponsors, Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited. So, Carl, really easy question. What is the statistical probability of me being hailed on two Sundays in a row while driving into the radio station?
Oh, hell, hail, Richard.
What the hell?
At least half right.
Yeah, exactly. At least half right. So, Carl, you do business valuation.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, this past year celebrated 20 years of stewardship of the company. We've had an opportunity to enjoy some pretty decent growth, have all the appropriate designations from the national organizations that confer such. We had the opportunity to value two 10-figure privately held companies this year, as well as obviously smaller companies. It was a very good year. Hectic during the last quarter.
And why was it hectic during the last quarter?
Oh, because we love clients that like to wait until the last minute.
Why did clients wait until the last minute?
Because the pending fiscal cliff meant that there was a possibility that the gift tax lifetime exclusion would drop from $5.12 million with portability doubling it down to $1 million per family on the 1st of January 2013.
But that didn't happen. Well, it happened for a day, but it didn't happen.
Well, Richard, maybe they read Frank Partnoy's book, Wait, The Art of Silence.
He was a great guest. Yeah, there was no reason to hurry. But, of course, the estate tax rate and the gift tax rate went up from 35% to 40%, didn't it?
Yeah, that's a big 500 basis points.
Well, to the people I hang around with, it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. So, the fiscal cliff, everything that happened about a week ago with regard to the House and the Senate passing the bill, does any of this affect valuation? I'm just curious.
Well, I think it'll be a big question for trust and estate attorneys who have in the past been more accustomed to selling the concept of the tax savings by retaining their services. So in the past, it wasn't that difficult to be worth over $1 million with your personal residence and some of your retirement accounts. But now we're talking about, if we're talking about $10 million that's available for the lifetime exclusion, that's also assigned the rate of inflation goes up each year. You're really only talking about 300,000 to 350,000 households in the United States.
That's in the whole country, in the United States.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
A lot of whom are situated on the East Coast or the Northeast.
Correct. I do point out in a recent blog that I put out that there's still approximately 11 states that have estate and inheritance tax at the state level, and many of them have a threshold that's closer between $1 million and $2 million, so they'll still be affected.
Although that's not California.
That is correct. California, yeah. Basically the Southwest is completely, you have to wait until you get to Oregon and Washington, and those are states that would be impacted.
Can I ask you guys a question, though? I mean, in terms of historical perspective and tax rates, what we're paying now, even after these, you know, dealing with the fiscal cliff and whatnot, how would you say they compare to, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago?
Not even close.
So we're still the wealthy are still getting they're still pretty low is what you're saying, right?
Low relative to prior rates, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, okay, back in the 1990s, Joe, if you go to estate tax rates, the exemption amount was $600,000 per taxpayer. Now it's $5.12 million per taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
Then it grew to $1 million, then $1.5 million, and up and up and up to $3.5 million, and now $5 million, now $5.12. Well, the IRS predicts that for people dying in 2012, there will only be about 3,300 estate tax returns filed where somebody, the trustee, actually has to write a check. There'll be more estate tax returns filed than that, like where the first spouse dies.
Right, mm-hmm. For basis purposes.
Yeah, correctly calculate, step up in basis, or use the portability, whatever. But the point is, nobody will be writing a check. There's only maybe 3,300 taxpayers. Well, if you go back to the last year that the exemption was $1 million, I believe it was 106,000 estates wrote checks for estate tax, and I would imagine when it was 600,000, it was more than 106,000.
So would it be fair to say that we like to complain and moan, but in the overall big picture, things are pretty rosy for a lot of people?
We like having short memories.
Yes.
So, Carl, you make this interesting point. You say that there's maybe 310,000 taxpayers, over $10 million in this country. We have a lot of estate planning attorneys running around on the loose in this country, also CPAs. You're saying most of their focus in terms of attracting clients was estate planning. If most clients that we run into don't have to worry about paying estate tax, what should all the professionals be doing?
I would argue that we shouldn't also have short memories. That mean just because our Congress created what I would call a windfall for the majority of the wealthy, that they don't sometime in the future decide to lower it again. So that's one thing that I think should be shared with their clients. I think another thing that we should be looking at as far as opportunity, not only for trust and estate attorneys, but CPAs, transaction attorneys, is the fact that we've got a lot of business owners and people that have a lot of their concentrated wealth in real estate that should be looking at some succession planning, which would obviously include those professional services, and if nothing else, to enhance value. In other words, there's two things that you're always focusing on. One of them is how to reduce my taxes and at the same time increase the value of the assets that I own. So I think there's an opportunity, but they're going to have to re-engineer their practices, I think.
Well, okay. Let's talk about here in the Southwest. We'll talk about Southern California.
Okay.
It's my opinion there's more estate planning attorneys in town than there are clients to keep estate planning attorneys busy, if that's all they want to do is help clients reduce estate tax, because there's not enough of these really, really ultra high net worth clients.
Well, in part, that's absolutely correct. There was a study that I did several years ago as far as where we would begin to develop our market. And we did take a look at the problem in Southern California, particularly San Diego, is everybody wants to live here. But when you do that, you start to create a certain dilution. Too many individuals are entering professional services to the number of people that require those services, which means revenues by practitioner drops off. So you're going to have a little bit of economic Darwinism going on.
Yeah, I think we're going to see it, both with CPAs and estate planning attorneys in San Diego, at least, because there's a fairly finite supply of extremely high net worth clients, and there's an overabundance of CPAs and estate planning attorneys. The smart ones, obviously, will change their focus or the direction to provide other valuable services, like you mentioned, Carl, helping businesses that maybe have a 3 or 5 year game plan to become more profitable actually do that, or obviously asset protection comes to mind. Very popular topic these days in our litigious society. There's so many other things that I think professionals could be doing for their, not necessarily ultra high net worth clients, but let's say their clients in the $5 to $10 or $12 million range of net worth, of which there are many, many, many here in San Diego. These clients will probably never have a taxable estate, or if they do, it'll be very slight, assuming the exemption stays at $5 million or above. But they still have many, many needs that go beyond what I would call traditional services, like just getting a living trust done or preparing an income tax return. What are your thoughts?
I agree. I think one of the issues that needs to be kept in mind is that when a lot of these taxes were originally drafted, the mortality rate as far as how old somebody was when they would pass away, it wasn't unusual to be in your 50s and 60s and die. So now I think there has to be more of an understanding of the fact that with medical capabilities that you might have somebody that's living into their 80s, and if they're already 80, there's a good probability that they'll live into their mid-90s. All of this basically means that if you have assets that are appreciating in value over a longer period of time, you certainly need to be conscious of that. But then there's the other issue. Even if that wasn't the case, oftentimes you have assets that are relatively concentrated risk, and a lot of families don't want to have to sell those assets to cover the estate tax, should there be an estate tax. So insurance, I think, becomes a more and more of a viable issue. Make sure that there's that liquidity.
I got to tell you my funniest estate planning story ever. I had a client, now deceased, but she lived to be 107. And when she was about 105, she did a family limited partnership because she wanted to take care of the kids. Well, the kids were 82 and 80, but she still called them the kids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, these poor kids, 82 and 80, they're still waiting. I shouldn't say it. This sounds sort of mean. They're still waiting to inherit. They're 82 and 80 because mom's 105. And she still called them the kids, and she treated them like they were still the kids. Great lady. I mean, just a really neat lady, great family. But you're like, my goodness, how can somebody live that long?
Well, we'll find out when we get back from this break with more of It's Your Money and Your Life. Stay tuned. We are back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio and our special guest, Carl Sheeler, with Business Valuations Limited. Welcome back, gentlemen.
It's good to be back, Joe. It's not hailing in here in the studio, which is nice.
We're nice and dry.
So the other morning, I stopped by my office in Morgan Run at 7 in the morning before going to a breakfast meeting, and it was 30 degrees. 3-0. The golf course was white. And I'm thinking, nah, there's no global warming or any climate change or any of that weird stuff going on. This is becoming normal. We're living in a...
It still beats the Midwest and the East Coast, you know.
It does. So, Carl, let me ask you a question. I've got a really good speaker coming up at Star San Diego in about a week and a half. That would be Paul Downey, who heads up the California Commission on Aging. In fact, I'm going to try to get him on this radio show sometime this year. He's going to talk about demographics in this country between now and 2030, where it's believed that over 25% of our country's population will be the age of 65 or older. Interestingly, about 25% of our population will be the age of 18 and under. Think about what that might do to unemployment in terms of there being not enough people for jobs, but...
And to put a fine point on it, 10,000 people a day for the next 20 years will be turning 65.
Exactly. But here's my question. Sorry, that was a long lead-in.
Okay.
Here's my question. High-net-worth families do estate planning where, to reduce their estate tax, instead of dying with their $5 million exemption, they will give it away during life. And so we have things in existence that some of our listeners have heard of, like family limited partnerships or family limited liability companies or GRATs and other estate planning techniques. But given that senior generations are living so long, many kids are getting, I'm going to be blunt, many kids are getting impatient waiting to inherit. Is that going to cause anything funny to happen, do you think, over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years in the estate planning world?
It's not even 5, 10, or 15 years from now. It's actually right now when we start to see a rise in the amount of inter-family litigation, whereby either you have siblings squabbling with siblings or Generation 3, which is usually the grandkids, disputing with Generation 1, wanting to get access to their trust funds early. So the litigation's already started.
So you think that might be a growth industry, you're saying, right now?
I would say that absolutely we're going to see an increase.
Scary.
We're going to see an increase. Yeah, they say money and blood, right? I think those two items aren't mutually exclusive. So when there's affluenza, which is kind of an inside joke.
There you go. I like that.
For amount of dysfunction that oftentimes gets exacerbated when you add the gas to the fire. In this case, gas is lots and lots of zeros and a dollar sign.
Well, yeah, here's what I see. A family does a family limited partnership. They put their, say, valuable real estate in it, and mom and dad are still the general partners, even though they gave away X percent to the kids or to trust for the benefit of the kids. But then mom and dad don't necessarily change their behavior in terms of how they run the assets or manage the assets or distribute the cash flow or make management decisions, even though the family limited partnership agreement might give voting rights to the limited partners. I mean, do you run into that?
Well, the issue is duty of care. And it doesn't necessarily just involve the controlling interest holders. It may actually also involve some of the other trusted advisors. If you have concentrated risk and you lost 40% of the portfolio that I have a economic right to as one of the partners in that partnership, I might have some questions as to the decisions that you make. If you make distributions that are inconsistent with what the provisions are in the agreements that we all signed, I might be able to demonstrate that you should be removed in that position, even if there are provisions that would tend to suggest I wouldn't have that ability to do that. That's why it's called litigation.
Are there some good preventive steps or measures that can be explored to help address these things in advance and hopefully avoid these major blows, maybe give them that bicycle they've been waiting for 40 years or something?
It's a great question. Having participated as an expert on quite a few litigated matters, what I think we have a tendency to do when we're trying to service the affluent is to look at the tactical and the technical, and perhaps we need to spend a little bit more time trying to really understand the people and the family members involved. If you're going to make gifts to somebody that is in their teens or 20s, maybe it's an idea to actually involve them in that process as opposed to just say, here's a document. By the way, you're going to be a trustee in a few years. It's like, I don't even know what that means. I may not be capable of doing it. I may not want to do that. So there's got to be more involvement. I think there has to be more of a holistic approach, but it's very difficult to get people that have always been very comfortable with the black and white of law and accounting and finance to suddenly start looking at it on more of a holistic approach.
So are you pro-offering this wild notion that, for example, my ilk CPAs actually have to learn how to ask clients, especially high net worth clients, excuse me, questions like, what is it that you really want to accomplish, or what are the key values that your family believes in?
Yeah, the way that we ask it is first of all, we think that the term exit strategy or exit plan should be stricken from the record, because essentially what you're telling somebody is you're giving birth to your child and you say, well, when your child dies, So sometimes the sensitivity starts with understanding the kind of investment, the emotional investment, the time and the energy and the money and the hope that went into this concentration of risk, and saying, what do you want your next chapter to look like? What are the things that we can do to help you? And at this point, this is where I kind of get up on the soapbox, and I've done this frequently, and say, and we do not have enough body of knowledge individually to be able to answer all of their questions and needs. We have to work with other trusted advisors.
And you can't predict the future either. I mean, all kinds of contingencies can occur, right, Richard?
Yeah, I think, well, the key thing here is this thing that I work in this field called family governance, and family governance is how high net worth families make decisions together and take accountability and responsibility for the decisions that they make together. But it also involves a lot of transparency, because if, for example, you're the beneficiary of a trust and you're not being communicated with, nobody's giving you financial information or other important information that you won't have access to, in many cases you come to the conclusion that people are doing that for some nefarious reason, as opposed to maybe they're just disorganized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's when people start hiring attorneys, and these things get very, very difficult. And we'll talk about that a little bit more after the break.
Yes.
But family governance is a very critical component of what we're talking about here.
But we've got to take a break. New sports and weather announcements coming up right now. Stay tuned. Oh, we are back with that great bonanza music with more of It's Your Money and Your Life, and over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
We want to thank UBS, Mr. Michael Quaranta and Drew Freitas, for being a major sponsor of this great radio show. And Mike, yes, I'm confirming lunch tomorrow at 11:30 at Elijah's in UTC. I'll see you there. So I don't have time to send you an email. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Polito Epic, Paul Polito and Don Epic up in Vista. Of course, Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited, the best business valuation organization. I used to say west of the Mississippi. Now they are the best one west of the Atlantic Ocean and east of the Pacific. That would include the whole country, in other words, for those of you who are geographically challenged. Rich Gaines with Family Legacy Legal, best estate planning attorney in town. My buddy, Joel Grushkin at Cost Segregation Initiatives, thanks for all the great work you did for me at year end, saving all of my real estate clients tons of money and improving their cash flow. And that's even more important now that tax rates are going up. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics. I think the baby is due on January 18th. We've got a check next week.
Her name is Quinn?
Her name is Quinn, and I've got to see if the baby's going to be on time. We'll keep the listeners posted. And then last week's guest, Sean Puckett with Regions Bank. Boy, did I ever get some complimentary emails about that show. Sean did a great job last week talking about this rather unique notion of the consultative and collaborative banker.
And he had a head cold, so I hope he's feeling better.
I'm sure he's feeling better, and hopefully he's back out in the surf, because there's been some good surfing. So thank you to all of our sponsors. And Joe, where can people find out more about our great sponsors?
Well, if they just get on their little old computers and go to iymoney.com, which is short for It's Your Money, iymoney.com, there is a tab along the top there that says sponsors, and all of our sponsors are there, and we thank them very much. There's synopses of their business, their emails, their phone numbers. And especially Carl, who's with us tonight, and his website is Biz Vals Limit Ltd. And you can find his information there. Where are your offices, Carl? I know you're scattered across the states. Your main office is here? Or?
San Diego is our headquarters. We have an office in San Francisco, Las Vegas, Albuquerque, New York, Boston.
And what's your best phone number?
Whichever one anyone wishes to call.
Well, give us one example.
1-800-286-6635. My personal extension is 211. Again, that's 1-800-286-6635. Or if you're fond of LinkedIn, just enter in my name. You'll get all the details that you want right there.
Every time I go to LinkedIn, I see your picture right there in front. You're very good at marketing, my friend.
Yeah, thank
you. You're like right there. That's good.
Excellent. And that's S-H-E-E-L-E-R, Carl.
All right. So we were talking about this concept of family governance. Oh, speaking of which, everybody, I've got a new YouTube video out. So just Google Richard Muscio on YouTube. You know, I have my own channel, but it's called the CPA Firm of the Future. So if you're wondering if your CPA firm is actually up to date and current and doing all the current cool things that you really need from your CPA to actually get the value that you deserve from your CPA firm, or if instead your CPA firm is a CPA firm of the past, which looks a lot like a dinosaur because there's, well, you know, lots of paper sitting around the office and they're just not very modern. Check out my new YouTube video, because it gives you 8 questions to ask your CPA to see if they're a firm of the future or if they're a firm of the past. And maybe you don't want to know, but check out my new YouTube video anyway. So Carl.
Yes, sir.
We were talking about this concept of family governance, which is how high net worth families make decisions together and take accountability. and responsibility for the decisions they make together, and how transparency and communication is a big part of that, including giving access to other professional service advisors who serve the family so everybody can actually look at the whole picture instead of just cubbyholing the poor valuation guy back in the corner while he cranks out one valuation, not understanding why he was even hired. How important do you think family governance and transparency and so on is with regard to your previous point that you're seeing a rise in intrafamily litigation?
I think it's absolutely important. And quite frankly, if nothing else, you actually might have a family that works better together, particularly if you have all those advisors with an alignment, so that when the family says this is what we're after, the accountant doesn't hear one thing, the attorney hears something else, and the other trusted advisors hear a third thing, it's all resolved, saving lots of time. The one thing that we all know about very ultra affluent families is the one thing they can't buy is more time. So anything that we can do to limit the amount of conflagration that occurs over the topic of money and control, and minimizes their time to enjoy their wealth, whatever we could do to help them out is a good thing.
Yeah, here's what let's assume you're an extremely wealthy family and you are the matriarch or the patriarch. If you, as the matriarch or the patriarch, have to call 9 or 10 different professionals to ask them the same question, to get 9 or 10 different responses, and then assimilate all of this information and feedback that you've gotten from those 9 or 10 individuals that you've called, guess what? Something's broken. You are not getting the value that you deserve from your service advisors, probably not any from any of them, because that's not how things should be getting done.
And that may be one of the reasons why we saw such an uptick in the amount of people doing last quarter execution of plans, because if they were deferring this long, it's probably in part as a result of not having clarity.
Yeah, although Congress, I think, contributed to the lack of clarity.
The knuckleheads on Capitol Hill.
Yes. Yeah, well, you can say that. Government intelligence, one of the best oxymorons in history. So, who just called Washington a moron? No, I said oxymoron, not moron, you moron. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I could tell you stories about what I was doing on December 31st with some clients. I mean, it was, I was just shaking my head going, oh, this is just, I can't even describe it because I'd be violating, you know, confidentiality agreements. But it was bizarre what we were doing to get stuff done, because nobody even knew up to the minute what was going to be, well, what the rules were going to be tomorrow. Really funny stuff. So, Carl, you, as a valuation expert, most people, if you ask them what they thought a valuation expert did, they would say you crank out numbers to determine like what your return on investment is, or whether that return on investment will continue to go or increase or decrease. But isn't valuation really about this thing, this horrible four-letter word? We have, what, a six-second delay here, but Kevin, don't block me out, because this horrible four-letter word is called risk.
Yeah, if we were really just going to...
Yeah, I know.
Do we have a
bleep? No, it's risk. What on earth does risk have to do with valuation?
Absolutely everything. There's so much focus on the economic benefit, in which we usually look at as how much profit, what's our net income, what's our cash flow. But really what a good valuation should do is center on what are those items within the asset class, whether it be an operating business, real estate, alternative investments, or even a portfolio, an amalgamation of investments, what is the multiple and how is it being influenced? What's the value drivers? What are the items that's causing the value not to rise in an entity or an asset or the interest that you hold? What are those items that would cause it to rise? What's causing it? What's influencing those items? That's what we're here to quantify. So most people think of risk, think of it as a multiple.
Like 3 times cash flow, 5 times cash flow, a multiple. So you're saying risk could include things like, well, there's 2 identical businesses on this planet. They do the exact same thing. They make the exact same amount of money. But let's assume one has an outside board of directors or outside advisory council and the other one doesn't. Would you say there might be different risk profiles for these 2 companies, even though they look identical on paper otherwise?
It's a very good question. And yes, there would be. One would argue that because there's some degree of outside input, you're going to have better governance, not unlike the conversation that we were having a second ago on family governance. So you might see a multiple go up. And as an example, we'll just say it was 3. A feature such as that might even bring it up to 3.5. Now, 0.5 doesn't sound like a lot, but if you have a $10 million, that's an extra $5 million in value.
So another example, would you say, is how a given company, an operating company, benchmarks or compares to its competition?
It's part and parcel of a good comparative analysis. That tends to be an area that, unfortunately, a lot of valuation firms don't spend adequate amount of time. But yes, absolutely, if you're performing well outside the median for that particular industry in a favorable way, that would be a reason why you would expect to see a considerably higher multiple than the median, which tends to be, unfortunately, very frequently used.
So another example, I saw this recently. Let's assume that you have two companies that are very similar, or call them identical to make the example simple. But one company, its contracts or its revenue, the money that comes in, it's subject to contracts it has with customers that last 2, 3, 4 years. The other company just picks up new business as they go without using long-term contracts. Difference there?
The existence of the contract, particularly multi-year contracts, if everything was the same, would obviously be, well, to me, it would be obvious that the company with the contracts has a better annuity for a period of time, so the multiple would increase.
So for our listeners, we just gave you about 4 really good ideas to make your business more valuable. So make sure you listen to the podcast if you missed this part, because a lot of businesses business owners don't think about this. They do think about it as just, well, my cash flow is X. And since my next door neighbor sold his company for 4x X, that makes my company worth 4x my X, notwithstanding the fact that you might be in a totally different industry with a totally different risk profile, with all kinds of different risks, not only financial. But there's so many risks out there. We just described some of them. Also, this thing we call counterparty risk, if you're relying on other third parties to accommodate transactions that you do. And those people don't hold up their end of, for example, a funding or an escrow account or something. There's all kinds of risks.
And if you have an ex-spouse, that could affect your business, right?
Well, no, it's not the ex-spouses that get you, Joe. It's the current spouses who are planning to become ex-spouses. Well, once they're ex, you sort of know what you've got on your hands. But, yeah, the two most feared words in California are community property. So, Carl, we're almost to the, well, we're going to, I think, take one more break and then come back. But I want to talk about getting back to this issue of risk and valuation. There's this sort of competing, it's almost like you have to be left brain and right brain. In some cases, you want to work to improve or enhance the value of entities. In other cases, you want to actually work to decrease the value. But it's also possible to decrease the value of things for estate, gift, and trust purposes, even while the value of a company or an asset is increasing, right?
Absolutely. We can talk about how to do that.
Okay, because a lot of people say, wait a minute, How can you increase something and still decrease it? And I'll give our listeners, before I take our last break, sort of a heads up. We want to increase the value of the things that we own while we're living, because we like to build wealth. And I'll make it, all the money managers on the planet faint when I say this. It's been my experience from the clients I work with that most people get very wealthy through concentrating their risk in one or two places, not
Absolutely.
Being diversified. But then at some point in your life, you get tired of the concentrated risk and you want to minimize that and become diversified, but you're not going to get wealthy again by being diversified. You're just going to maintain or slightly enhance your wealth. But you typically do not get wealthy in this country by being very well diversified. And I know just the phone's going to start. I'm going to get so many emails from money managers tomorrow going to say, Richard, but it's true. It's concentrated risk that builds wealth. And I'm going to ask Carl his opinion about that when we come back.
Yes. We have
this is our last break. It's your money and your life.
Stay tuned.
All right. We are back with the last segment of It's Your Money and Your Life. Over to Richard for our... We're in the home stretch.
We're in the home stretch. So since I offended most money managers who were listening to the show, but not all, I didn't offend the really smart ones. when I made the point that the wealthy families I know all made their great wealth through concentrated risk or being in one or two different types of businesses as opposed to being diversified. But there's another issue that goes along with that, and Carl, I'm going to ask you to comment on this. Many advisors are incentivized in the wrong way to really give good, true, independent, objective advice, especially to affluent families. And here's an example. Let's assume that I own a company and all of my net worth is in this one company. I've built this up with my blood, sweat, and tears over many, many years, and we know a lot of people who've done this, and I'm making, pick a big number, our cash flow is $40 million a year. We're a very successful company. And so we would value it $120 million, $150 million, depending on our risk factors, you know, $100-something million. And so the money manager says, well, you should sell that company and become diversified because you have too much risk. But they never point out how the family can still enjoy $40 million a year of income, especially after paying income taxes from the sale on what is now maybe under $100 million of assets. And they never ask the question, well, what do you need to live on? What would your life be if you didn't have $40 million, if you only had $10 million income? No, it's just you should diversify because, well, you know what? If you never sell your company, I never have any assets to manage, and I get paid for having assets under management.
I have a response to that.
Go ahead.
Really what it comes down to is what is the family's liquidity needs? If you're generating $40 million a year and that equates to a 17% yield, can you find any other investments that are passive that has anything close to that? And oh, by the way, you give up control.
Yeah, and loan sharking is illegal. So.
So what the real issue is have you considered partial liquidity as opposed to full liquidity? Sometimes what you can do is bring in the talent pool from the private equity community. And they'll buy a minority interest, they'll infuse a lot of capital, but you'll also have the capital of what they know and who they know, and you may be able to take a company that had a value of $150 million and in a relatively short period of time, triple or even have a tenfold increase in the value of that business. So there are a multitude of options. You just have to make sure that whoever is advising you doesn't have a conflict. In other words, they're fee-based, perhaps, as opposed to assets under management.
Right. In other words, they're not making an amount of money based on your behavior. They're making an amount of money regardless of whether the client takes your advice or not, so that you can just be totally independent and objective. And also, you made a really good point. And with regard to boards of directors and advisory boards, it's frequently what do these people know and who do they know and in what circles do they move that you can truly create these collaborative benefits where 1 + 1 equals much more than 2. With regard to, say, growing companies or finding liquidity or an exit strategy. Okay, so we got about 3 minutes left. This concept of I want to improve the value of the assets that I own, but with regard to what to report to the government, I want to actually decrease it. What am I talking about? Am I crazy?
No, absolutely not. And this comes back to where there is a real opportunity for the trust and estate community, whether we're talking about the attorneys or accountants, to take a step back, particularly if there's assets that they have that have appreciated, that the first goal would be is if you know that sometime in the future there's going to be a partial full liquidity event, you may want to start transferring some equity interests out of that business into a trust or to other individuals so that when you do have that liquidity event, that appreciated asset is not in your estate, it's outside of your estate. So you can have two goals going on at the same time. Elevate the value of the business, and if you know you're going to do that, start passing some of the interest out. The reason that you do that is there's a concept that you and I like to call it freeze and squeeze, so that I may be able to push out 50% of the value of the business, and let's say if that value is $5 million on a pro rata basis after a discount, it could be half of that, $2.5 million, which means I can get more of it out of my estate. So the remaining $5 million is a hypothetical in 10 years might be worth another $20 million. So yeah, this is an ongoing process. This is not a one and done type of situation. And I think if I was going to say anything to my brother advisors, valuation is not a one and done process either unless you're very transaction oriented.
No, valuation should be an ongoing consultative relationship in my opinion. And in my opinion, it's one of the things that CPAs miss most often with their business clients is they do not encourage their clients to have ongoing valuation done and beyond that, what I call ongoing risk metric measurement or key risk indicator measurement as a regular reoccurring project. They just don't. They bring you in, Carl, the expert, after the document is signed or well, we did this family limited partnership and transferred all these interests. Now tell us what it's worth. No, that should have been done first.
Well, one of the things that we can do as far as the advisory services is even in the provisions in agreements that are being drafted, whether we're talking employment agreements, buy-sell agreements, operating agreements, bylaws, amendments, is that there's provisions that you can enter into those documents that would cause an increase or a decrease in value based on those provisions.
Gentlemen, we have to unfortunately end it right there. Carl, thank you so much for being our guest tonight.
Thank you very much.
Richard, you have a great week. Hey, next week,
two special guests, Joe. Who is it?
Right. Wendy Gillespie and Lorenzo Theoni, the producers of Allegiance, the record-breaking show at the Old Globe. And then the following week, Mr. Irwin Jacobs, when we're making history with in San Diego Radio here. You have a great week, and thank you to Kevin Terrell on our board and to Dave Sniff, our program director. Have a great week. Stay dry, everybody. Good night.
Rapid Transmissions maintains some of the largest fleets in San Diego. Rapid will build and stock transmissions in their state-of-the-art facilities for your particular fleet vehicles. This means your fleet can be back on the road immediately. You're running a business, so you have no time to be out of commission. Trust me, no company will move faster for you than Rapid. The experts at Rapid have been serving you for 41 years, and they back their workmanship with the best fleet warranties in the business. Trust Rapid with the opportunity to earn your fleet business today. You will never go anywhere else. They have three convenient locations in San Diego, Escondido, and La Mesa. I trust my vehicle to Rapid, and if I had an entire fleet of vehicles, I would trust them with Rapid as well. If it has a transmission, Rapid will fix it. Do not wait until your vehicles are down and you're out of business. Call Rapid today. 1-800-562-7675. 1-800-562-7675. Or rapidtransmissions.com.
We follow the story. The deal.